Hello and welcome to the final part of this mini-series on the French Revolution as part of the overall Nations of Charlemagne series. Today, the topic is how Napoleon transformed France, the Napoleonic state as a end point to the French Revolution. Before I get started, there are a couple of things I really want to get across in terms of what I want to achieve for this lecture. First of all, this lecture is one of the natural endpoints of the Nations of Charlemagne series. The series began with three episodes concerning the post-Roman situation in the Western world. And the fourth episode talked about the rise of the Carolingian Empire and the rise of Charlemagne. 1,000 years later, Charlemagne died in the year 814. Napoleon will be deposed exactly 1,000 years later in the year 1814. It seems as if history has come full circle, and we have a second Charlemagne and a second attempt to revive not only the nature of Charlemagne's empire to some degree, but even the political geography of Charlemagne's empire. Nevertheless, a topic as large as that concerning Napoleon's impact on Western European history can't be covered in one lecture. I have a series of lectures planned after this. This is going to cover Napoleon, an overview, and his impact on the French Revolution and his impact on France up until 1812. The next two lectures I have planned are going to focus on the French Revolution being exported to Italy and being exported to Germany. And the final lecture I planned for the Nations of Charlemagne series is undoing the French Revolution, the triumph of the Holy League and the coalition powers against Napoleon and his exile to St. Helena, ultimately to St. Helena, and the system of the Congress of Europe that emerges after the Congress of Vienna. Also, I want to point out that this isn't a general Bonaparte stream. This is a stream about the political situation which Napoleon inherited and how Napoleon grew into being one of France's and indeed Europe's greatest statesmen. This is a lecture about Consul Bonaparte and Emperor Napoleon I. If you want to discuss the various battles and the military history behind Napoleon, that topic has been discussed ad nauseum, but the actual statesmanship of Napoleon has been less discussed. And this is primarily a political stream, a stream about the politics of ideas and, of course, the arena of royalist history persisting throughout all of this time and the various analogies you can draw. If you read Oswald Spengler's The Decline and Fall of the Decline of the West, in the introduction you come across a rather interesting anecdote. There are many various anecdotes and historical allusions into what Spengler tried to create as a world history or a history of becoming. And this is a direct quote from The Decline of the West. Napoleon has hardly ever been discussed without a side glance at Caesar and Alexander, analogies of which, as we shall see, the first is morphologically quite unacceptable and the second is correct. While Napoleon himself conceived of a situation akin to Charlemagne, the French Revolutionary Convention spoke of Carthage when it meant England, and the Jacobins styled themselves the Romans. So here we have a series of neoclassical ideas that are underpinning this entire sequence of historical events. Interestingly, the idea that France, throughout the course of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, is engaged in something akin to a new ideological struggle, a new Punic War with a new Carthage in the form of the maritime strength of Great Britain, soon to be the United Kingdom. But I also want to investigate these various analogies, less so Alexander, but more so drawing comparisons and Napoleon's own direct comparisons between himself, Caesar, and that of Charlemagne's empire, and tying this into the notion of the Nations of Charlemagne as a series in its entirety. But first, we need to talk about the background to Napoleon's rise. Napoleon's inexorable rise to power took place amid the backdrop of the Directory regime, the result of the coup of Thermidor that deposed Maximilian Robespierre and his supporters, neutered the Jacobin Club, and brought an end to the Reign of Terror. The Directory was victorious over a radical Jacobin revivalist movement led by Babeuf in his Conspiracy of Equals. Paul Barras, pictured on the left, and Napoleon were victorious against the Royalist uprising in Paris, and General Hoche was victorious against de Charette in the Vendée that ended the war in the Vendée in 1796. Though peace in France and with France's external enemies, both internal, external, remained elusive, in regards to internal enemies, the Vendée was never really pacified, and there was a Royalist insurrection, the Chouannerie, who persisted throughout the lifetime of the Directory, and was only mostly put down with the arrival of Napoleon as First Consul. After the 13th of Vendémiaire, the Royalist coup in Paris, the new Directory government was formally established around a new constitution of 1795, which diffused the powers originally vested in a now obsolete National Convention, which was supposed to be akin to something like the Rousseauian conception of the general will of the people or national sovereignty. In place of an emergency government, a formal five-man executive was established, the titular Directory. The directors were drawn from a new legislature, the Council of the 500, while a new upper house, the Council of the Ancients, could veto laws proposed from the 500. The 500 were elected indirectly from each department. A system of elected judges was established in an attempt to separate the legislature from the judiciary. To assert the power of this new settlement, this new constitution, and indeed correcting the political mistakes of the Girondins in 1792 and 1793, the new government abolished the various revolutionary committees throughout Paris and the Paris Commune government itself, which had been mainstays of Jacobin power in Paris. Power was redistributed to a new city, a new series of city divisions called the arrondissement. In so doing, the new government hoped that the sans-culottes of the city of Paris would be unable to wield an effective sword of Damocles against the rest of France and her new political situation. The law of the maximum, which guaranteed an artificially low price for bread in Paris, was amended because ultimately this came at the expense of French farmers and only to benefit of a small political class in old Paris and, of course, the lower orders. This was revoked, and to compensate, the government looked to foreign imports of grain. Faced with a worthless paper currency, the assignat, the legacy of Talleyrand's biens nationaux, or the goods of the nation, based on property seizures, the government transitioned to a new currency, the French franc, restoring the old French currency that had been abolished in the 17th century in favor of the livre. Exploiting the popular loathing of the assignat and the hyperinflation that came with it, the government even held a ceremony in the Place de Vendôme to destroy the printing presses that had produced the original assignats. Unlike the assignat, the new currency, the franc, was backed by silver and gold. Moreover, France's small bullion reserves in part necessitated the looting of Napoleon's later foreign adventures to stabilize the new currency. Still facing the problem of an empty treasury, the government declared partial bankruptcy in 1797 and increased taxes on luxury goods and even windows. In the aftermath of the Jacobin purge, Royalists had become tolerated by the new government as the lesser of two evils. However, the Thermidorian coalition themselves, while anti-Robespierre, were resoundingly Republican. And to prevent any real concessions to the Royalists, all members of the Directory were from the old convention, and regicides, those who had voted for the original death of Louis XVI, while a majority of the 500 were members of the old convention. There were also around 100 Royalist deputies. Among the members of the first Directory, there was Le Révélier Lepeau, whose presence demonstrated that the new establishment was virtually hostile to Christianity. As with Hébert, discussed in the previous lecture, with the cult of reason and Robespierre and the cult of the supreme being, Révélier Lepeau supported another Republican replacement for Christianity, theophilanthropy. There was also Lazare Carnot, the organizer of victory, the organizer of the Levée en Masse, who went from opposing Robespierre to opposing the domination of the Directory by Paul Barras, the most prominent of the Thermidorians. Carnot described Barras as without faith and without morals, in politics without character and without resolution. He has all the tastes of an opulent prince, generous, magnificent, and dissipated. And I think that is very much the image we have on this image on the left in terms of inculcating this sense of majesty. The domination of the Thermidorians and the triumph of this new constitution quickly proved illusory. In 1797 election, the Royalists made resounding gains. with royalists and royalist sympathisers now in the majority and controlling the presidency of both legislative houses, they began to repeal measures taken against émigrés and non-juror priests. The Directory accused the royalists of treason and decreed that any Jacobin or royalist in Paris was to be shot without trial in what amounted to a Thermidorian self-coup, the coup of the 18th of Fructidor, led by the Republican victor of the Vendée, General Hoche. With Paris under the control of the Directory, the election results were annulled, and those accused of conspiring against the Republic were either deported or executed, while Paul Barras chose this moment to settle old scores with his political opponents, such as Carnot. Rather than stabilise the Thermidorian regime, this self-coup crippled it. With the constitution a dead letter, and with a delicate balance of power between the royalists and the moderate Republicans shattered, radical Jacobins, whose support was now needed to crush the royalists and their various uprisings in Provence and Lyon, were readmitted into the government. Among the members of the new Directory were Merlin de Douai, who had helped draft the Law of Suspects at the height of the Terror. Prescriptions were announced for various nobles who had been politically active in the Terror. New commissions were established to target and deport priests in what amounted to a general intensifying of the anti-Catholicism of the government, which forbade religious observance on Sunday, though by design the Republican calendar was meant to purge Sunday from living memory. With radical Jacobins and moderate Republicans holding seats in the new Directory, the central government was effectively paralysed. The Directory continued to pursue the expansionist aims of its predecessor, the National Convention. After the Battle of Fleurus, France had acquired the Austrian Netherlands and was resolved to establish a new Gallican border at the River Rhine. By 1795, Britain remained the most ardent of France's enemies and struggled in vain to keep the First Coalition together after 3 years of war and no end in sight to the French occupation of Belgium. The British and the Austrians proposed a general congress of Europe's powers to mediate peace, which France refused, after which Austria remained the only major power in opposition to France on the continent. Jourdan and Moreau, France's most prominent generals at the time, along with Hoche, would invade Germany and take Vienna. Bonaparte was promoted from General of the Interior after Vendemerie to General in Italy, which Carnot expected to be nothing more than a diversionary campaign. Bonaparte at the time was considered the protege of Paul Barras, a zealous Republican and Thermidorian partisan, so this original appointment was political rather than meritorious. 2 days before Napoleon left for Italy in 1796, he had married Josephine de Beauharnais, the widow of Alexander de Beauharnais, who was blamed for the French failure at Mainz and executed at the height of the Terror. Indeed, she followed her husband not to execution, but was nevertheless imprisoned. With Thermidor, Josephine was released, and her Parisian salon became a centre of political intrigue. She was indeed the mistress of Paul Barras before her engagement to Napoleon, and as such was a prominent figure in the Directory era of France in her own right. And we should also speak to this original dependency of Napoleon on Barras, to which he owed not only his military command, but also his wife. Napoleon and Josephine married in a civil ceremony. The revolution had not abolished religious marriage, but had made civil ceremony the only legally recognized union in France, a practice that remains in France today, and Napoleon would later export throughout all of Europe. The main armies in Germany under Jourdan and Moreau met with defeat at Amberg and Wurzburg and were defeated. Napoleon's diversionary campaign, however, was far more successful than Carnot or anyone else could have ever imagined. Within 2 weeks, Napoleon had defeated Savoy on the border, occupying the territory of Piedmont, Austria's ally, before attacking Austria's principal northern Italian fortress at Mantua. Every relief effort made by the Austrians, most famously at Arcole and Rivoli, was defeated. Victorious against the French in Germany, the main Austrian army now turned to face Napoleon in Italy. Faster than anyone had anticipated, Napoleon imitated the objective of Jourdan's campaign by probing deep into Austria, except this time from the south, within striking distance of Vienna, before the Austrians sued for an armistice. When it came to the signing of the Treaty of Campo Formio in later 1797, the Republic was in disarray following the anti-royalist self-coup, and what is remarkable is that Napoleon was the principal signatory to the peace, the warlord turned peacemaker, while the political situation in the Republic continued to deteriorate. Moreover, Napoleon was a key anti-royalist figure whose military loyalists in Paris under Augereau executed the purges in Paris and augmented his own power and the power of the army at the expense of the Republic, that being Napoleon's own power. Through the treaty, Austria was removed from the war. France's Gallican borders were finally recognized at the left bank of the Rhine, carved out of Austrian and imperial territory. While the situation established for Italy itself left Austria with a footing in Venice, France had established client states in central Italy, and this situation would soon prove untenable for a lasting peace. Campo Formio built upon the earlier precedent of the Republic of Mayence and established sister republics, nominally republican allies of France, such as the Cisalpine and Ligurian republics, which were in actuality French client states. While in Italy, Napoleon had directly imitated Caesar with his military dispatches, amounting to a full-scale Napoleonic propaganda effort that drew analogies between Napoleon and Alexander, Scipio, Hannibal, indeed Caesar himself, while this ephemeral appeal to military glory was coupled with Napoleon's loot train of plunder from the various cities liberated from the yoke of tyrants by French arms, from Milan to Venice, where not only did he end the 1,000 years of Venetian independence, but he sent the horses of San Mark, themselves the loot of the crusade, the Fourth Crusade of 1204, back to be displayed at the Louvre, which would later christen the Musée de Napoléon. Napoleon had left Paris, the protégé of Barras, and upon returning, Barras was Napoleon's dependent, while Talleyrand, now foreign minister of France, rushed to make an alliance with Napoleon. Only Josephine, it would seem, was slow to grasp the shift in the balance of power in France, as she had openly committed adultery during Napoleon's absence. With Britain, France's only remaining foe, plans were drawn up for an invasion, though this quickly demonstrated to be unfeasible due to the dominance of the Royal Navy. I also want to bring back an obscure quote from Spengler again, which is In Decline of the West, referring to Leibniz. Leibniz, without doubt the greatest intellect in Western philosophy, the founder of the differential calculus and the analis situs, conceived or cooperated in a number of political schemes, one of which was to relieve Germany by drawing the attention of Louis XIV to the importance of Egypt as a factor in French world policy. The ideas of the memorandum on this subject that he drew up for the Grand Monarch were so far in advance of their time, 1671, that it has been thought that Napoleon made use of them for his Eastern venture. Even thus early, Leibniz laid down the principle that Napoleon was able to grasp only clearly after Wagram, so this is after 1809, that acquisitions on the Rhine in Belgium would not permanently better the position of France, and that the neck of the Suez would one day be the key to world dominance. Britain was actively engaged in India in wars against the various princes, principally Mysore and the Marathas. With French rule in Egypt firmly established, France would lend material support to the Indian princes, weakening the British Empire and forcing her into a negotiated settlement. The Directory supported this plan, less because they anticipated great success from it, rather an imperiled government under Paul Barras hoped to keep Napoleon as far away from Paris as possible, and here they believed Napoleon had committed a serious political blunder. As a member of the French Academy of Sciences, Napoleon brought with him some 150 scientists on his expedition to Egypt. En route, and with the loss of only 3 men, Napoleon took Malta and ended the independent states of the Knights of Malta before reaching Alexandria. Within 1 month, central Egypt was conquered, and the cream of the Mamluk army, the essential vassals of the Ottoman Empire in Egypt, had been defeated at the Battle of the Pyramids, only to be followed by the French naval disaster at the Battle of the Nile, after which Napoleon would not be able to receive reinforcements and resupply from France. Trapped, Napoleon decided to strike further into the Ottoman Empire, into the Levant, up to the city of Jaffa. As the situation for the French army grew more and more desperate, Napoleon's army committed a massacre at Jaffa, with the pretext being that the defenders were prisoners of war on parole. Plague then reached the army, and Napoleon was halted at the siege of Acre. Napoleon's seizure of Malta and the Tsar's patronage of the Knights of Malta gave Russia a pretext to attack France. Already troops were in Switzerland aiding revolutionary forces attempting to establish the sister Helvetic Republic, and Russian Generalissimo Suvorov inflicted a string of defeats on the Franco-Swiss armies. Coupled with unrest in Naples, Austria was brought into a second coalition. While victorious in Switzerland, French gains in Italy were abandoned by 1799. Napoleon, who had kept abreast of developments in Paris, abandoned his army in Egypt under his own volition to return to France. Though Napoleon was technically a deserter and his campaign was now stymied and would ultimately suffer collapse in his absence, he was quick to present his victory, his campaign as a victory, emphasizing the scientific gains of the expedition that would form the basis of the science of Egyptology and, of course, his earlier victories, that of Alexandria and the pyramids. Back in France, Napoleon was the center of consideration for schemes hatched to alter the political situation in France. With the outbreak of the War of the Second Coalition, the Jacobins dominated the government, only to be ousted when France suffered a series of early reversals. The Republican cause was imperiled yet again, and Paul Barras and the Directory had failed to provide adequate leadership. Men like police chief Joseph Fouché were terrified that with the fall of the Directory, the coalition would ally with the royalists under de Provence, later Louis XVIII, and restore the French monarchy. Only Napoleon, it was perceived, thanks to his campaign and image-making, had the popularity with the people and the support of the army to save the Republic. Purely on the power of Napoleon's name, Lucien Bonaparte, his brother, was elected president of the Council of the 500. Director Sears, a mainstay of the revolution, author of What is the Third Estate, and Roger Ducos appealed to Bonaparte to become the third man in the new ruling coalition, supported by Talleyrand and Fouché. Sensing that opposing the coup was pointless, Barras resigned as director and positioned himself as amenable to reform. Only the Jacobins were left to seriously oppose the coup. Napoleon entered into both legislative chambers to announce their dissolution. Against claims that Napoleon was betraying the Republic, Napoleon perhaps rightly declared that the constitution had been destroyed in the aftermath of the 18th of Fructidor and the subsequent attempts to annul elections and contrive majorities in the houses that would work with the Directory. Once in the Council of the 500, Napoleon was accused of outlawry and he seemed to faint. Some of the deputies were now brandishing daggers and he barely escaped the chamber with his life. It was Lucien, not Napoleon, who steeled the resolve of his grandees to expel the deputies from the chamber and complete the coup. A rump assembly appointed Napoleon, Sears and Ducos provisional consuls of France and reorganized themselves into a legislative corps while the streets of Paris were silent, indicating tacit consent to the coup. In contrast to the protracted deliberations and factional disputes that had underpinned the framing of the first three Republican constitutions, the Constitution of 1799 and its promulgation was swift, a coup within a coup. Ducos and Sears, who had envisioned a sharing of power, were sidelined, and Lebrun and Cambaceres were invited to assist Napoleon, who was now first consul, though unlike a Roman consul, which was the obvious historical allusion, and so much of the neoclassical nomenclature of the text, Napoleon was vested with dictatorial powers for a term of 10 years. The irony being that Napoleon exploited much of the constitutional planning of Sears to establish himself as France's head of state, and simply took on the role for himself and massively expanded the powers of that role of head of state. In the absence of military support, Sears was powerless to oppose Bonaparte. Rather, Sears had seriously underestimated Napoleon's political skill and his ambition. In the place of a bicameral legislature of the Directory, what was instituted was referred to by Benjamin Constant, who served as a member of the Tribunate, a regime of servitude and silence, with order as its principal goal. Napoleon controlled appointments to the new Council of State, the effective cabinet of France, whose membership amounted to all the ministers of the realm, and was responsible for preparing legislation. The Senate was a new body whose role was to consult the consul and draw up list of notables who were to be drawn from popular election to the bodies who would debate on legislation, the Tribunate, and vote on legislation, the legislative corps. The system of departments was centralized further when Napoleon re-established the monarchical system of intendants with the system of prefects, central government surveillance of each department. Even the Tribunate, that had no right of initiative or the right to vote on law, with members such as Benjamin Constant, wasn't compliant enough for Napoleon. Underpinning the system, which withdrew from the earlier precedents of power emanating from a national assembly as representative of the popular will, was the plebiscite, which personally confirmed Napoleon's powers by direct vote of the citizenry. Though Napoleon was no doubt popular enough to win these votes outright, voter intimidation was rife and turnout was low, so Napoleon confirmed the plebiscite on his new constitution by fraudulently doubling the turnout, which showed that over 99% of voters backed Napoleon in his reforms. The pattern of fraudulent plebiscitary mandate would confirm Napoleon as first consul for life and then emperor of the French. Despite not wielding power through a personal mandate, Robespierre and his domination of the Committee of Public Safety was nevertheless organized under a similar principle of emergency powers necessitated by an impending overthrow of the Republic. Similarly, Napoleon's newly confirmed powers were dependent on rescuing France's military situation. Shortly after his confirmation as consul, Napoleon imitated Hannibal by crossing the Alps and winning the decisive victory at Marengo. With that one decisive victory, the Austrians withdrew from northern Italy. Coupled with Moreau's victory at Hohenlinden, the Austrians sued for peace again, confirming the presence of France's sister republics in the north of Italy at Luneville. With Britain once again alone of the major powers in the coalition, Britain and France signed a definitive peace treaty, so-called, at Amiens, the first time France was at peace with all of Europe since 1792. Having brought France peace, rather than surrendering his dictatorial powers, Napoleon then had them confirmed by plebiscite. In the interim, Napoleon turned to colonial affairs and was unable to reclaim France's possession of Haiti, leading to his decision to sell the recently reacquired Louisiana colony to the United States. Talleyrand remarked at Amiens that France had finally achieved international recognition of her natural borders, the limit of the possible scope of her ambition, and to push her border any further would imperil any peace established on the principle of the balance of power in Europe. Prophetically, French consolidation over Switzerland and Napoleon's annexation of Piedmont in Italy not only precipitated a decade of increasingly arbitrary enlargements of France's European territory by Napoleon, but gave Great Britain, now the United Kingdom, a convenient casus belli to resume conflict with France until Napoleon's ultimate defeat, indeed his double defeat. The drastic transformation of the nature of revolutionary government has led many to consider the coup of Brumaire the end of France's revolutionary decade. Indeed, Napoleon himself declared, "The revolution is over. I am the revolution." But to what extent can we consider Napoleon a republican and a revolutionary, and his state a continuation of the Republic rather than simply an emanation of Napoleon's own power, a Napoleonic state where the personality and vision of Napoleon in fact superseded the revolution, using, say, for example, the comparison of Carlyle's Great Man? And here I'm just going to read a few excerpts, paraphrased excerpts, from an article called Je suis la Révolution Française, Carlyle, Napoleon and Napoleonic Mythos by David R. Sorensen. And here he begins by talking about a relatively recent history by one Dominic Villepin, who was a prime minister of France during the era of Chirac. For Villepin, Napoleon's life illustrates his boast that Je suis la Révolution Française. In particularly Carlyle, and peculiarly Carlyle language, Villepin celebrates the emperor's legacy. Not a day goes by without my feeling the imperious need to remember so as not to yield in the face of indifference, laughter, or jibes, and to advance in the service of the French nation. Villepin's response suggests that even in an age dominated by postmodern skepticism, hero worship remains a vital force. As Carlyle observes in Heroes, unbelievers might mock the tendency, but in no time whatever can there entirely eradicate out of living men's hearts a certain altogether peculiar reverence for great men, a genuine admiration, loyalty, adoration, however dim and perverted it may be. Nonetheless, Carlyle rejected Villepin's conviction that Bonaparte incarnates the French Revolution. According to Carlyle, Napoleon betrays the very principles that first distinguish him as a great man. He apostatized from his old faith in facts and took to believing in semblances. And that's a quote I'm going to come back to quite often. Carlyle was characteristically contradictory, independent, and prescient in his assessment of Napoleon, though his views are seldom mentioned either by historians or biographers. From an early stage in his career, he rejected the myth of redemption that the emperor, together with his publicist, Emmanuel Lacasse, had artfully cultivated in the memorial to St. Helena. And this was perpetuated by a wide range of writers, including Byron, Walter Scott, Hazlitt, V. Fini, Balzac, Stendhal, Chateaubriand, and of course Victor Hugo. Bonaparte's example is crucial to Carlyle as a reminder of the limitations as well as the possibilities of hero worship. Keenly allied to the charge that he is an advocate of might equals right, Carlyle seeks in the final lecture of Heroes, The Hero's King, to distinguish between a ruler who governs in deference to eternal laws of nature and God, in this instance he cites Cromwell, and one who invests himself with the power and the authority to transcend these laws, Napoleon. In essence, the difference between true and false heroes lies in their capacity for belief, veracity, and conscience. Carlyle, the alleged worshipper of physical force, advances a view of heroism that he equates with spiritual rather than physical force. It is a distinction that perplexes and intrigues him and will dominate his edition of Cromwell's later letters and speeches and later his biography of Frederick the Great. The comparison that Carlyle draws between Cromwell and Napoleon in Heroes is partly shaped by his desire to redress the balance of their respective reputations. He was familiar with the biographies of Napoleon written by Scott and Hazlitt. While Scott, in the life of Napoleon Bonaparte, endorses the romantic view of Napoleon as a tormented genius, he attacks him for his Cromwellian contempt for political liberty. It must always be written down as Bonaparte's error, as well as his guilt, that the misusing the power which the 18th of Brumaire threw into his hands, he totally destroyed the liberty of France, or as we would say more properly, the chance which that country had of attaining a free and at the same time settled government. He might have been a patriot priest. He chose to be an usurping despot. He might have played the part of a George Washington, and he preferred that of a Cromwell. Carlyle recalls the distinction in Heroes, where he assails those who identify Cromwell with selfish ambition, dishonesty, duplicity, a fierce, coarse, hypocritical Tartuffe, and then comes contrast with Washington. Hazlitt refers briefly to Cromwell in his life of Napoleon Bonaparte, which Carlyle used in the French Revolution. Referring to the fact that they both were involved in the equestrian accidents, Hazlitt remarks, "If this is anything more than a mere casual coincidence, it might seem as if the usurpers, or those who had seized the reins of government in their own hands, have an ambition to be charioteers, where there is a sense of power and of difficulty and dexterity in directing it." Yet elsewhere, Hazlitt exonerates Napoleon in terms that Carlyle might have found useful. In Hazlitt's view, Napoleon is trapped between the need to assert his authority and desire to realize the ideals of the French Revolution. Napoleon was not strictly a free agent. He could hardly do otherwise than he did, ambition apart, merely to preserve himself and the country he ruled. France was in a state of siege and required a military dictator to repress internal treachery and headstrong factions and repel external force. Who then shall blame Bonaparte? The English, who having set the example of liberty to the world, did all they could to stifle it, all the continental sovereigns, who were only acquainted with the principles by their fear and hatred of them, all the emigrants, traitors to the name of men as well as Frenchmen, all to the Jacobins, who made the tree of liberty spout nothing but blood. For Carlyle, a religious sense is the essential characteristic of any true hero, who must recognize that his own strength is a faint impression of God's majesty, and whose shape is ambition around his irrevocable fact. Napoleon's career illustrates the violation of the fragile boundaries that separate man from God. In claiming the territory of divinity, Bonaparte allows his authority to degenerate into falsehood. Carlyle connects Napoleon's lack of belief to his tyranny. He is a lesser figure than Cromwell because he never acknowledges the limits of his power. No silent walking through long years with the awful unnameable of this universe, walking with God and faith and strength in that alone. Napoleon lived in an age where God was no longer believed. He had to begin not out of the Puritan Bible, but out of the poor skeptical encyclopedias. Napoleon conceives of human beings mechanically rather than religiously. They are agents of his will, and he values them as an extension of his personality. Carlyle's spiritual perspective allows him to view Napoleon's character from a vantage point, unencumbered by what Peter Gale has called the Napoleonic legend. According to the script, Napoleon is to be regarded as the representative of the revolution as it was understood by the bourgeoisie, and as the creator of the unparalleled sense of glory. Napoleon, though raised a Catholic, lapsed like a number of revolutionaries, becoming a deist and then in all likelihood an atheist before his two exiles, though he never possessed the anti-Christian zeal of the radical Jacobins. Anti-clericalism persisted throughout the life of the Directory. In place of the discredited cult of the Supreme Being arose the deistic cult, the aforementioned Church of Theophilanthropy, which was founded by Thomas Paine, converting Réveillé-le-Pau after the coup of Fructidor. Réveillé-le-Pau and the anti-Christians, emboldened by the purge of Raulis, celebrated the cult of the Décadé, the 10th day, and attempted to make this 10th day of the Republican calendar the new French Republican Sabbath, holding processions in Notre Dame akin to the earlier festivals of reason organized by Hébert. Churches throughout France held ceremonies on the Décadé, and despite the absence of any real dogma and only vague appeal to Stoicism and Epicureanism, the new religion could only mimic Catholic sacraments as national festivals, even the Mass with hymns taken from the writings of Rousseau and feasts dedicated to him and Socrates, among others, with special thanks again to the influence of Paine, we see dedications to the founding fathers of America. Napoleon understood the social utility of religion in service of order, yet unlike a figure such as Robespierre, he had no desire to establish a cult Napoleon, having experience of the constant failure of such cult systems and their limited support among the masses, despite official state sanction. Napoleon also understood that the royalists in France would never accept a republican profession of faith, or indeed any absence of faith. Pope Pius VI had died during the tumult of the first months of the Second Coalition War, and finding the embalmed body in the possession of France's allies, Napoleon organized his formal ceremonial burial to appeal to the cardinals, now in conclave, to elect a new pope. Moreover, the papacy was less positively disposed towards the coalition powers as they may have been back in 1793, following a number of imperial secularizations of church territory in Germany, and this will make up a significant part when I come to Germany in a future lecture. After Marengo, and with France's forces yet again in control of northern Italy, it suited both Napoleon and the new Pope Pius VII to come to an arrangement. This arrangement was the Concordat of 1801. Church property wasn't restored, it had allowed exiled priests to return to their parishes, and most significantly, repealed the remnants of the civil constitution of the clergy. In fact, most priests that had sworn the oath found themselves ostracized by the restored Catholic establishment in France. Pre-revolutionary Gallicanism underpinned this new arrangement. Napoleon would appoint bishops and officiate over the Catholic Church in France, which was recognized as France's majority church. Free worship on Sunday was permitted once more. Nevertheless, church processions, church conduct, even the catechism and the teaching in seminaries were subject to state regulation. Napoleon instantly abrogated parts of the Concordat meant to establish Catholicism as the new state religion by establishing rights for Protestants and indeed Jews. In the case of Jews, abolishing the ghettos and permitting their general freedom of movement and, of course, entry into various professions, which has since been barred to them, while the conduct of Judaism, as with Christianity, was placed under the purview of state control. These so-called organic articles were declared by Napoleon unilaterally, meant to be accepted by the Pope on the face of it. The return of Catholicism also meant the abolition of the Republican calendar and the restoration of the Gregorian calendar, while the deistic cult and the cult of reason that found favour during the Revolution were officially banned. Though the restoration of Catholicism had drawn the Revolution to a close in one respect, during the remainder of the consulate, Napoleon completed what had been attempted by Necker and established a central bank of France. Under Napoleon's direction, neoclassicism reached its apogee with the empire style, replacing the late Rococo of Louis XVI and the classical minimalism of the Directory style. Perhaps the most obvious example of this is Napoleon's spurning of the powdered wig. From 1799, Napoleon aided in the adoption and the spread of the metric system throughout France and Europe. Napoleon was responsible for establishing a secular and standardized system of education throughout France, the so-called lycée. Despite the various declarations of the rights of man, despite the edicts of the August the 4th following Bastille Day and everything that followed, revolutionary France had failed to establish an effective system of civil law, akin to, say, the Allgemeines Landrecht of Prussia, that built upon Frederick the Great's principles of enlightened despotism, albeit it happened under a successor of his. It is perhaps appropriate that Napoleon, who at first considered himself an enlightened despot, with Frederick the Great as one of his many heroes, implemented the Code Civil, or the Napoleonic Code. Though it was Napoleon's ability to bring stability to France which enabled such a radical reform of the laws of the French realm, Cambaceres, the principal author of the code, had attempted to draft such a thing for presentation to the convention and the directory, which was rejected both on the basis of creating short-term instability in France, while France was so mired in factionalism so as to frustrate any consensus, and of course the Republic at that time lacked the raw power required to push through such reform and have it universally agreed upon. Though intended originally as a revolutionary code, Napoleon later came to think of the process as a new system of Roman law, with himself as a new Justinian, Justinian's code, the Napoleonic code. But this was far more radical in the sense that the code was new, secular, and written in the vernacular, not Latin, as opposed to a compilation of law based on precedent and ancient tradition, indeed ancient liberty. And this is what Carlyle refers to in terms of Napoleon embracing the new as opposed to representing the force of eternity. Thus, the code was one of the most radical products of the French Revolution. With the implementation of the code, it was followed by an overhaul of the criminal justice system, which differed significantly from, say, common law countries, and that the magistrate and prosecutor's roles were combined, while ad hoc general rules were supposedly the preserver of the legislature, not the judge, in an attempt to limit case law. Following from the French desire of the revolutions to establish the convention and the general will, not the judge, as the source of law. In practice, that now meant the emperor, of course, rather than the general will of the people, unless you subscribed sincerely to the idea that the emperor is the embodiment of France and thus the general will. And of course, Napoleon would often make that claim. The French system, moreover, established a presumption of guilt in fact. Among the factors that clashed with the spirit of the Concordat of 1801, divorce was legalized. As the Napoleonic state grew, the Code Civil was exported throughout Europe. Napoleon was the target of assassinations, over 20 during his time, during his reign, and such assassination attempts provided a useful mechanism for justifying targeting political groups, various political purges, and ultimately necessitating an increase in the consul's power. By now, Napoleon already wielded more power than most kings of France, making him a monarch in the purest sense of that term, if not yet a king. The Daggers plot and the Infernal Machine plot, whose perpetrator organizations have been infiltrated by Pouchet's secret police and subsequently royalist and radical Jacobins, were targeted and eliminated by the state. With the resumption of hostilities between Britain and France, plots were often instigated or accused of having foreign backing. Among the main opponents to Napoleon during this time was General Moreau, who had retired after his victory at Hohenlinden. At the so-called Club Moreau, many royalist sympathisers and disaffected Republicans flocked to him and suggested that Moreau rather than Bonaparte should be the dictator. Long aware of Moreau's hostility to Napoleon, a supposed plot was uncovered conveniently that linked Moreau to the Bourbons and an attempted royalist restoration. Louis-Anton de Bourbon was abducted as the symbolic Bourbon target and executed on Talleyrand's initiative. In the aftermath of the prince's execution, Napoleon believed that only a system of dynasty would guarantee his system of governance in the wake of these repeated assassination attempts, or so was the official justification. Though Lucien had fallen from the emperor's favour, the emperor had come to rely on his elder brother Joseph as an effective political mediator, while his best cavalry general, Joachim Murat, had married his sister Caroline some years before, Caroline, of course, being one of the most intelligent of Napoleon's relatives. Though Napoleon had reconciled with Josephine after her infidelities, she had become a political liability, in that after 8 years of marriage, Josephine, now in her 40s, hadn't produced a child and thus an heir for Napoleon. Napoleon, however, was intent on glorifying her regardless and drawing an heir from one of the members of his extended family. On May the 18th, 1804, the Senate officially bestowed the title of Emperor of the French upon Napoleon. The historical analogy was vital for the political utility of such a moment. The French had effectively speed-run through half a millennia of Roman history in 15 years, from the deposition of the last king, Tarquinius, to the conferment upon Octavian of the title Augustus by the Senate. The Senate conferment of such a title was at least superficially meant to create a Caesarian conception of monarchy, founded from the Republic, and thus a technical continuation of the Republic as a form of princeps, or first citizen. Napoleon was thus emperor of the French Republic until 1808, when allusions to the Republic were jettisoned for the empire. But this was only one of many conscious historical analogies Napoleon drew upon to substantiate his claims of imperial authority. As iterated with Spengler at the beginning of this lecture, the foundation of French history was in the Empire of Charlemagne. Napoleon's realm was thus the restoration of the Roman province of Gaul and of the Carolingian Empire, controlling Charlemagne's old capital of Arcon or Aix-la-Chapelle. In imitation of Rome and all Roman imitators after, Napoleon took the eagle as the sigil of the empire, while for his dynasty, Napoleon searched for a precedent that would elevate the Bonaparte family above the House of Capet. Napoleon found his symbol, older than the fleur-de-lis of France, in the Bee of Childeric, the father of Clovis, the founder of the royal line of Merovingian kings. The Bonaparte imperial dynasty was thus a conscious imitation of both the Romans, the Merovingians, and the Carolingians, the latter in that being akin to Charlemagne, he was establishing a new Roman Empire on French soil. But in drawing upon these symbols, not because of their intrinsic value or meaning, but rather their social and propagandistic utility, this exercise was thoroughly postmodern, going back to this idea that Napoleon was a man of semblances rather than truths or facts, so much as that word can be used synonymously. Though, of course, it should be remembered, if we go back to previous lectures and the precedent set there, the idea of grandeur as a political tool in France, had been utilized brilliantly from Cardinal Richelieu to Louis XIV. And so in that strict sense, in terms of the employment of grandeur and utilizing the political value of glory, military glory, Napoleon was very much continuing in the vein of his predecessors, his royal predecessors. Unlike his early Roman predecessors, however, Napoleon wanted a distinct coronation that would set the pattern for his dynasty and lent on the artistic powers of David to capture that moment and demonstrate it before the citizens of the empire. Notre Dame de Paris was fashioned once again from the location of the Fate of Reason to the Church of Theophilanthropy to a neoclassical imperial coronation chamber. Theophilanthropy really rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? To demonstrate the strides made in his relationship with the church, Pius VII was brought to Paris to preside over the ceremony and bless the emperor's reign. Though not to follow the blunder of Charlemagne, Napoleon crowned himself emperor with a Carolingian crown replica before crowning Josephine while wearing a golden Roman laurel crown. After the Pope had officiated Mass, Napoleon declared, "I swear to maintain the integrity of the territory of the Republic, to respect and enforce respect for the Concordat and freedom of religion, equality of rights, political and civil liberty, and to govern in the sole interest, happiness, and glory of the French people." As Emperor of the French Republic, presided over by the Pope, it is unclear when Napoleon was crowning himself whether, again, this practice and imitation of Eastern emperors and czars, whether he was acknowledging God's authority, the will of the French people, or he was acknowledging no authority higher than his own and his own destiny. The imperial coronation had served as a decisive provocation against the Holy Roman Empire. In a desperate maneuver, fearing that Napoleon had the desire and the capacity to seize the ancient imperial throne from the Habsburgs and amalgamate it with his own, Francis II of Austria established the Empire of Austria with himself as history's only double emperor for 2 years. Tsar Paul of Russia was assassinated, no doubt with British backing, as he was pursuing alternatives to facing Napoleon with his League of Armed Neutrality. The new Tsar, Alexander, formed a pact with Austria in opposition to Napoleon as the oppressor of Europe and disturber of the peace of the world, despite Alexander's own Francophile temperament and sympathy for aspects of the revolution. Camped with his army in Boulogne, awaiting the arrival of the French fleet to invade Britain, Napoleon abandoned the invasion to attack this new Russo-Austrian alliance in the War of the Third Coalition. It is here when Napoleon renamed the French army to the Grande Armée. With remarkable speed, Napoleon isolated the Austrian army under Mack at Ulm, surrounded it and destroyed it before entering into Vienna and occupying it, establishing a seat of power in the Schönbrunn. The Russian army had arrived under the leadership of the Tsar, together with the remnants of the Austrian army under the Emperor, and attempted to cut Napoleon off from Paris. It is here at Austerlitz, the anniversary of Napoleon's coronation, that he won his most decisive victory. Forcing the Russians into retreat and compelling the Austrians to surrender, the Emperor Francis himself meeting Napoleon in battle afterwards, after the battle. At the Treaty of Pressburg, Napoleon was able to turn his Carolingian aspirations into reality. The defeat of Austria and her allies led to France's abolishing the Holy Roman Empire and the French Empire extending itself over most of Germany and the Low Countries, save Prussia, while all of mainland Italy fell under French sway. Austria itself was forced to make territorial concessions in the Tyrol and Venice. In concert with France's imperial turn, what had once been sister republics, such as the Cisalpine Republic, were turned into the Kingdom of Italy, with Napoleon as its king, utilizing the symbolism of the Iron Crown of Lombardy. Rather than extending the revolution, Napoleon became one of the foremost exponents of the Pacte de Famille, which had led to Bourbon rule in France, Italy, and Spain in the 18th century. Securing the Bonaparte dynasty throughout Europe, his relatives were placed on the throne of Naples, Holland, after the fall of the Batavian Republic, another sister republic. His son-in-law, Eugene de Beauharnais, was placed as the viceroy in Italy. Bonaparte was placed on the throne in Lucca, while with the defeat of Prussia, a new Bonaparte kingdom was created in Westphalia. If we are to return to our previous analogy on the Punic War, with Britain being a surrogate for Carthage and thus the principal enemy of this new Rome, Napoleon's continental triumph concealed a disaster that would imperil the future of his new empire. At Trafalgar, both the French and allied Spanish fleets were destroyed by Horatio Nelson. The defeat was so decisive so as to confirm British maritime control for the next century. At once, Napoleon's only major willing ally, Spain, had been cut off from its colonial empire, and any prospect of a British invasion would have to wait until France had concluded a massive program of naval construction. Napoleon's inability to touch Britain meant that Britain could continue to fund France's enemies in Europe and blockade non-European goods from French markets. Shortly following Napoleon's creation of an organization of German states, the Rheinbund, dependent on him, with willing supports from states such as Bavaria, Prussia, with Russian support, declared war on France. Swiftly, the Prussian armies were defeated at Jena and Auerstedt, and Napoleon entered Berlin. From Berlin, Napoleon implemented a continental system whereby any nation in France's orbit, whether it be a Napoleonic vassal like Westphalia or an unwilling ally like Austria, placed an embargo on British trade, and as Napoleon's control over Europe grew, this meant that in principle, British goods could not enter Europe. In practice, the blockade was nearly useless at deterring British smugglers, and Napoleon had to rely on his allies implementing the scheme, who often proved unreliable. From Berlin, Napoleon pursued the Russians to Eylau, where he suffered his first military setback before defeating the Russians decisively at Friedland. At Tilsit, Napoleon met Tsar Alexander of Russia and concluded a peace whereby Russia lost no territory, but conceded to the creation of a semi-independent Poland in the Duchy of Warsaw and agreed to join the continental system. From 1807 to 1808, Napoleon was at the height of his power, and nominally, most of Europe was part or subject to or allied with his empire. Nevertheless, the continental system was not working, and British goods were entering the continent through Portugal. While en route to invade Portugal, Napoleon placed French garrisons through the fortresses of his ally Spain. Spain's alliance with France was unpopular, and in 1808, King Charles IV and his hated favourite Manuel de Godoy were removed from power. Despite the Franco-Spanish alliance already being detested and the march of French armies through Spain considered a national humiliation, rather than de-escalate the situation, Napoleon summoned both the former king and his son and presumed heir Ferdinand de Bayonne, nominally to mediate the dispute between them, only to then force them to repudiate their thrones and place Napoleon's own brother, Joseph, on the throne as King of Spain. With French forces already in Spain, Napoleon expected the Bonapartist coup to be accepted as a fait accompli, only to be opposed by the vast majority of the orders of Spain, who were by and large hostile to the implementation of any system derived from the French Revolution, sparking the Peninsular War. After a general uprising in Madrid, Napoleon was forced to maintain a heavy garrison in Spain, while the French administration there would end up fighting a losing battle against the Portuguese, the Spanish guerrillas, and the British forces that would come under the ultimate command of Wellington. The impact of the Spanish disaster reverberated throughout Europe. Tsar Alexander distanced himself from Napoleon, and after a failed meeting at Erfurt with the Tsar, the Austrians took up arms against Napoleon, defeating him personally at the Battle of Essling in 1809, before Napoleon was able to reverse his military disaster at Wagram. Though the Austrian rising against Napoleon had been premature, and Austria was forced to cede even more territory to France, Napoleon had become convinced of the need to establish a long-lasting dynastic peace in Europe, which could only come from repudiating his wife Josephine and marrying into the Austrian imperial family, the Habsburgs. His marriage to Mary Louise, the daughter of Francis II of Austria, not only provided a recognition of his legitimacy as a monarch, but allowed him to sire a male heir, Napoleon Francis, who from his birth in 1811 was given the title King of Rome. The period from 1806 to 1812 witnessed a significant centralization of the emperor's authority. The consulate government retained its essential character through the imperial era, but was ever more compliant to Napoleon's edicts. Napoleon pressed for greater government control over the church that came to resemble the ancient feuds between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, though now Napoleon had a virtual monopoly of temporal authority in a way that no king or emperor had possessed since Philip IV of France or even Otto the Great of the Holy Roman Empire. Napoleon's papal envoy, Cardinal Fesch, attempted in vain to reconcile the two parties, only to be repudiated by both emperor and pope. In 1808, Eugène de Beauharnais, Napoleon's viceroy in Italy, annexed the eastern parts of the Papal States, and at the height of his war with Austria and Spain during 1809, Napoleon issued the Schönbrunn decrees, whereby he invested himself with the power of the Carolingians, drawing upon the precedent set by Charlemagne and Pepin, his apparently august predecessors, declaring that the papacy had misused the original donations of Pepin, and after 1,000 years, confiscated the territory of the Papal States under his assumed authority as emperor. This territory became the basis of Napoleon's Kingdom of Rome that was to be given to Napoleon Francis upon the birth of Napoleon Francis 2 years later. The Pope responded by excommunicating Napoleon, and Napoleon responded by imprisoning the Pope until he not only lifted the excommunication, but signed a new and far less favorable concordat. Napoleon had effectively repeated the medieval argument and won through sheer force, though Pius, while imprisoned in Paris, would not yield to Napoleon's dictates. Such aggressive action against the Pope did nothing but inflame anti-French sentiment in Spain further. Similarly, after Talleyrand had questioned Napoleon's aggressive foreign policy in the wake of the failed Congress of Erfurt, the foreign minister was subject to a formal public dressing down before the emperor. The annexation of the Papal States was fueled by Napoleon's vendetta against the papacy. In the wake of Napoleon's defeat, France established itself in Carniola, Carinthia, and Dalmatia, creating the Illyrian provinces, a buffer zone from which to exert French authority at Austrian expense, expand French control over the Adriatic, augmented with its possession of Corfu, and if need be, place pressure on the Ottoman Empire. The annexation of those Croatian lands precipitated another guerrilla insurgency. Holland was ruled by Louis Bonaparte, another brother of Napoleon, and intended to be nothing more than a conduit for Napoleon's authority. But of all the Napoleonic statelets, the Netherlands suffered extensively from the loss of trade with Britain, and King Louis was determined to be an effective king of the Dutch and resist the arbitrary dictates of France. His resistance, coupled with the fact that Napoleon wanted to dissolve the Dutch nation to effectively cancel France's loans from Dutch investors, while the British led an amphibious expedition to the Netherlands during the Walcheren campaign, led to the annexation of the Netherlands by France in 1810. By 1812, Napoleon had occupied Oldenburg and all the German states with North Sea access, ostensibly to better enforce the continental system. Finally, Catalonia was incorporated only partially into France, as the French-Spanish kingdom's authority was crumbling, appealing to the ancient Carolingian precedent when French borders extended to the Ebro. By 1812, the empire had 130 formally constituted departments. With Catalonia, it would possibly make 134, though this was never to be. And of course, Illyria was never constituted into the normal structure of France, retaining an independent system of administration. By 1812, references to the Republic had been replaced by references to the Empire. France was a hereditary monarchy, and Bonaparte held more sway over Europe than any one man since Charlemagne. Moreover, the constant expansion of the French state represented a triumph of the Napoleonic system, but increasingly, and had the Napoleonic Empire been allowed to consolidate, it would have resembled an empire of continental Europe, And here is another article I quickly want to draw from the conclusion of this lecture, and you can find it in the description. It is Napoleon, Charlemagne, and Lotharingia, Acculturation and the Boundaries of Napoleonic Europe by Michael Brose. The Napoleonic adventure is one of the most paradoxical episodes in the history of modern Europe, and the recent shift in scholarly interest towards the political and social impact of imperial rule has actually deepened the paradox. Wolff redefined the significance of the Napoleonic period in his aptly titled Napoleon's Integration of Europe. The problem is simple yet profound. How could an empire with so short a life leave such a lasting impact anywhere outside of its heartland? Yet the work of Wolff and countless other scholars working in different national contexts shows that Napoleon's rule did exactly this, because the lasting impact of French rule did not always correspond to the amount of time Napoleon had given an area. The Vendée remained inexplicable well into the 19th century. A country, a people so strangely blind and so strangely bewildered, as Michelet famously put it, of course, Michelet being one of the most famous left-wing historians of the 19th century. Indeed, when the thesis of François Fouret is remembered that it took even France almost a century to come to terms with its own revolution, then the paradox not only deepens but widens, for even the impact of the regime on France itself cannot be taken for granted. Although in his insistence that Napoleon stabilized the revolution for the French, Fouret perhaps missed the heart of the dilemma of his own theory that has done so much to heighten. The one great given of an early historiography, that the Napoleonic Empire was the pure and simple extension of France, la grande nation, shared by conservatives and Marxists alike, is now open to question. Pabon saw the whole regime in terms of paradox and pointed directly to it, when he said Napoleon's claims to the crowns of both Caesar and Charlemagne were incompatible. It must now be asked which territories were best assimilated to the Napoleonic Empire and why. Napoleon made much of the Carolingian analogy, yet when he chose to compare himself to Charlemagne directly, it was with accurate, specific reference to political geography. Until me, he told Girard, France still resented Caesar. The supremacy of the Pope, the Empire of Germany, the King of the Romans were destroyed by me. Charlemagne gave up the lot. Perhaps the most concrete comparison to be made, therefore, between Napoleon and Charlemagne is in the geography of the empires that they ruled. Almost eerily, however, Edward Gibbon's account of the reign and character of Charlemagne in Book 5, Chapter of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, written only 15 years before Napoleon's coup, had already, in truth, left Napoleon, or indeed future commentators, little to invent in the way of Carolingian paradigms. The essential for Gibbon's Charlemagne was very close to the essence of the imperial achievement Napoleon himself prized, moving the centre of the empire beyond France of Caesar. Gibbon's vision of the parameters of Carolingian hegemony offers a remarkable and precise insight into the nature of the Grand Empire and of the nuances of the degrees of control Napoleon exercised within it. To ponder some of Gibbon's more precise observations on the limits of the Carolingian Empire is also to trace the borders of Napoleonic Europe as both embraced France, Spain, Italy, and Germany. Gibbon is most telling in the details of imperial power, however. Gaul had been transformed into the name and monarchy of France. Charlemagne pursued and confined the Bretons on the shore of the ocean, and that ferocious tribe, whose origin and language are so different from the French, was chastised by the imposition of tribute, hostages, and peace. After a long and evasive contest, the reunion of Aquitaine to France enlarged its present boundaries. With the addition of the Netherlands and Spain as far as the Rhine, he instituted the Spanish March, which extended from the Pyrenees to the River Ebro. Barcelona was the residence of a French governor. As king of the Lombards and the patrician of Rome, he reigned over the greatest part of Italy, a tract of 1,000 miles from the Alps to the borders of Calabria. Charlemagne was the first to unite Germany under the same scepter. The Alemanni, so formidable to the Romans, were faithful vassals and confederates of the Franks. If we retrace the outlines of this geographical picture, it will be seen that the Empire of the Franks extended between east and west from the Ebro to the Elbe, or the Vistula, between north and south from the Duchy of Beneventum to the River Eder. Gibbon's vision of the core of Europe is far from fanciful. Only the fact that Charlemagne got further in pacifying the rest of France than did Napoleon detracts from an almost exact parallel, together with the fact that in 1814, the Bourbon legitimists, unlike the Merovingians, rose again in Aquitaine. Napoleon had to fight to reattach the Midi, the Vendée Militaire, and the Massif Central to France after the Revolution, and it is in these regions, rather than the conquest beyond the interior of 1792, where the term reunion should really be applied. He resurrected the Spanish march in the last desperate years of the empire, although his grip on it was less sure than attributed to Charlemagne by Gibbon. Napoleon revived this impossible domain almost more by will than design, as emerges when Charlemagne's failure past Gibbon are juxtaposed to the limits of Napoleon's own hegemony. In the north, Gibbon points to the unsteady conquest of Germany, of Weser, to Charlemagne's failure to push for acewards towards the Elbe, while in Italy, Gibbon had no doubts that the Carolingian Empire stopped south of Rome. Beneventum insensibly escaped from the French yoke, despite the nominal submission of its ruler to Charlemagne. In Spain, Gibbon noted how Charlemagne, without distinction of faith, impartially crushed the resistance of Christians and rewarded the obedience and service of the Mohammedans. It is less Napoleon's famous remark in Egypt about conversion to Islam, which springs to mind, than Suchet's use of French troops to collect feudal dues in Valencia, in flagrant contrast to the spirit of the Valladolid decrees in an effort to win the support of the local aristocracy. The parameters of the European heartland, as conceived by Gibbon, were actually put to the test by Napoleon less than two decades later. The result was less a vindication of the Carolingian universal monarchy than the revelation that the core of the empire was neither France nor a wider Christendom, but an area, a true macro-region, akin to Lothar's impossible domain. It was in the limits of his hegemony, rather than his twin imperial Lombard and imperial crowns, that Napoleon truly usurped the inheritance of Charlemagne. By the early 19th century, there appeared to be a logic of Lotharingia. It became Napoleon's inner empire. Lothar, as the elder son of Charlemagne, received the richest prize at Verdun. The province is centered on the great trade axis of the Rhine, the Meuse, the Rhone, the Saône, together with the valley of the Po. The conquest of the 1790s, Napoleon's included, had already brought most of the Isthmus folly under France, but time, even so short a space of time as Napoleon's adventure allowed him, proved this to be the natural heart of his empire. The Atlantic Revolution may have reorientated the commercial wealth of Europe, but one result of the Anglo-French Wars was to reinforce the importance, the alluvial core of non-maritime Europe. However fragmented politically the lands of the impossible domain, it if extended slightly westwards to include northeastern France, represented the most settled, relatively advanced part of Europe throughout the early modern period. Revolutionary Napoleonic aggression finally brought it together under a single political hegemony, if not quite under one ruler, forming the economic raison d'etre of the continental system, even if the impact of the blockade deprived it of its natural coastline components. This was the natural centre of gravity of the Napoleonic imperial enterprise, much more so than Napoleon's original political springboard of old France. And this is where I'm going to leave it for this lecture, in the sense that we talked about old France being the original springboard. Next time, I'm going to be discussing the effects of the French Revolution when it comes to Italy and it comes to Germany, of course, forming in this Carolingian Empire. And the final lecture of Nations for Charlemagne will be covering Napoleon's defeat from 1812 up to the failure of the Congress system by 1822 and the death of Napoleon, of course, in St. Helena of 1821. So thank you, everyone, for listening. I'm just going to go through all of the super chats and the comments which I have received over the three episodes of this series. Hopefully those of you who did send super chats over the previous nights are here, so you can hear me, or at least will watch this video at some later time, so it won't really matter. Right. Rarebit for $5 Australian simply says, thank you for your videos. Well, thank you very much, Rarebit. Dark Arts by Adrian for $10. Love this content. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Dark Arts by Adrian. John Gordon for $10. Again, just thank you, AM. So thank you, John Gordon. Now, Nick S for $10. Did you consult Carlyle for this series? If so, what are your views on him? Well, yes, if you've this was obviously from a previous episode, but if you definitely watched this episode, yes, I certainly did. Consult Carlyle for this episode. In terms of, and indeed all of the series, in terms of what I think of him, I think it's better to reframe that question in terms of what I think his utility is. I mean, one of the things I hope I've done in the previous three lectures is give everyone at least an overview of the political situation in France between 1789 and 1812, because it can be quite daunting to not only is Carlyle's literary style quite inaccessible, especially for readers nowadays, but it's also, I think, very difficult to embark on Carlyle without having a underpinning or general understanding of the events of the French Revolution, especially as he tends to take more of a POV literary approach to it rather than taking the approach that I do, which is referring to this all in terms of larger political events and how everything impacts everything else. So I would recommend that you read Carlyle, but have an introduction into the history of the French Revolution before you do so. In terms of his actual historical utility, in terms of his views on the French Revolution, I'm not as aggressive as he is in terms of his denunciation and degeneracy of the French nobility. That was a large section of it, but I don't tend to blame, especially Louis XVI and the people, less the people around him. I tend to blame the weakening political situation and the catastrophe that was the long disastrous reign of Louis XV for demolishing faith, not only in the monarchy, but in the moral fabric of the French nation as a Catholic nation. I think that needs to be understood. And it's something, again, I reference Carlyle again when I talked about the Ancien Régime in an earlier lecture. So maybe go back and look at that. But in terms of doing Carlyle and really investigating his claims, I suggested at one point of maybe doing a comparison between Carlyle's Frederick the Great series and von Ranke's own history. Maybe. Comparing Carlyle with, I don't know, some Marxist contemporaries of that time could be quite interesting, but that would be a historiographical stream and not just a history stream which employs elements of historiography. Nevertheless, thank you very much, Nick S., for your contribution. So thank you very much. Faith Knight for $50. Thank you very much, Faith Knight. That's very generous of you. Thank you for your hard work in researching material for this important topic. Favorable artistic depictions of terrible men like Marat and Robespierre has always made my blood boil. Reminds me of a certain modern martyr of the American extraction. Yes, I do. Well, again, this is so integral to the idea of historical myth making is your ability to take the most repugnant figures in all of history and make them appealing to the likes of posterity. I mean, you'll find the images of Marat grotesque. I think maybe David's painting of the death of Marat is perhaps the most absurdly grotesque painting of all of history in terms of the serenity of the subject matter, in terms of his encapsulation of Marat, and in terms of the pure disgusting character that is Marat. Again, nothing more than an agitator who was constantly calling for blood and radicalizing everyone around him. I have a slightly softer spot for Robespierre, but definitely not for someone like Marat. So I think that's very much a favorable impression. But again, just looking at this period and looking at the Napoleonic skill of myth making and going back to this idea of semblance, and that's ultimately all of Napoleon is. All of this is to some extent a postmodern experiment, which is all the more remarkable, the remarkable thing about it. And I almost feel that if we're to superimpose this in a modern context, so many of these ideas were just so prevalent around that Napoleon was able to take all the developed strains, the Carolingian revivalism, neoclassicism, the general antipathy towards the Ancien Regime, and he was able to refashion it into something which was both incredibly modern, yet also appealed to ancient precedent, and so could fulfill this idea of a return to nature akin to, again, on the one hand, you can say Rousseau is incredibly radical, but some people definitely interpret him as actually a very reactionary thinker in terms of his appeal to hallowed antiquity. Interesting ideas, but I think in terms of this thoroughly postmodern conception of Napoleon and his whole idea of semblance and myth making, this and all of the ridiculous artistic depictions of Napoleon, all of these are just are there to dazzle you through the sight of aesthetics. And of course, it's not just the battle, it's the painting of the battle. I'm not particularly a fan of Gladiator the film, but there is a moment where Joaquin Phoenix, who plays Commodus, talks about the idea of spectacle. He talks about the idea of giving people a vision of Rome's greatness. In a sense, that's all Napoleon is, except he is actually going out there and winning the battles and providing the spectacle to the Parisian mob back home. And of course, the Jacobins were also, exemplars when it came to the idea of providing bread and circuses. I think Napoleon just took that to the next level. Mike, 2017, for $10, thank you very much. People swayed by empty rhetoric and desperation is understandable, but how were the various ambitious reformers and cult-like beliefs seen by the people? Were these things just ivory tower fantasies? Yes, perhaps more so than at any other point in history. The reason why they got so much support as they did is because they were state sanctioned, and there was a lot of piggy banking off the saints' days and off essentially the idea of arranging a festival like the Fête de Fédération, which really sort of began this, the first celebration of Bastille Day. People were drawn to it less because they understood the innate symbolism of such an action, but more the idea is the Republicans and the early revolutionaries who weren't as of yet Republicans wanted to make all of these occasion celebrations feasts. They wanted to hand out food. They wanted to amuse people. They wanted to inspire people. They wanted to provide a new sense of Republican post-revolutionary awe, which banked upon all of these older ideas which are being refashioned. But as I demonstrated with the Church of Theophilanthropy, all this can do is take something like the Catholic Mass, add a Calvinist tinge to it, and get rid of the Christian hymns and replace them with hymns based on the writings of Rousseau. So yes, there was and of course also using the same buildings, the same churches, and in some cases even the same priests who had gone over fully to the revolution, as many priests were ardent participants of the revolution as well. Some were more successful. I think actually the Church of Theophilanthropy was more successful because it had a longer gestation period than, say, something like the Cult of the Supreme Being, which went off with a colossal bang and then completely vanished from all existence after the death of Robespierre, because it was so intimately associated with him. And thus, when he was discredited, the entire system just went away like that instantly. And of course, the understanding of this idea that these are just ivory tower fantasies is confirmed when Napoleon believed that the social utility of bringing back Catholicism with the Concordat took priority over establishing a cult Napoleon, as I termed it. Enlightened Despot for $30 Canadian. Thank you so much. It's very generous. There was a European docudrama on the French Revolution for the bicentennial. It was supposed to be a celebration with an upbeat score, but the horror and tragedy overtakes the makers. It ends with Candles for the Dead. Yes, I've seen that in both English and French. It has an all-star cast, if I remember. Jane Seymour plays Marie Antoinette. You have Peter Ustinov playing Mirabeau, and you have Sam Neill playing Lafayette. I forget who else is in it. But yes, you have an upbeat score to begin with, and it doesn't really work at any point, because even in the first stage where you have a depiction of the Fête de Fédération, you still have the horror of the Bastille, which separates the beginning from that. So I don't think there's ever a case in the French Revolution where you can actually justify an upbeat score. But there is, it's fine. I mean, it's a good introduction in some senses. It's got decent production values. I would say it's too much like a soap opera in terms of focusing on the personal relationships between all the characters and how those develop. I'm particularly infuriated by how Danton is made into a protagonist for the whole series, and even Danton's physical appearance is made less repellent, and he's less obese than he was in real life. So there is an element of romanticizing these historical figures. Like, I believe the character who plays Robespierre is also more attractive than he was in real life. And again, this tortured figure. And it's interesting. I think you should watch it nevertheless, even though there are elements of it that are definitely paused. And like I said, you can't make a cheerful celebration of the history of the French Revolution without omitting about 95% of the details. Polish ambassador for 10 Polish zloty. Thank you very much. What was status of late aristocracy in revolution? Okay, well, what do you mean by that? What was status of late aristocracy in revolution? Does that mean what was the status of the aristocracy late in the revolution, or what was the status of the aristocracy just before the revolution? I can answer both. The status of the aristocracy before the revolution was that they were the main political force frustrating the king's reforms. When the revolution happened, many of them stood by their privileges, went into exile and became emigres and lost their property. Many others actively joined the revolution, such as Lafayette, such as Mirabeau, and of course Philippe Égalité. I despise the term Philippe Égalité and the conscious sort of revolutionary simpery of the Duc d'Orléans and his betrayal of his cousin. And of course, invariably, those figures who didn't go into exile were executed. Some of them remained, and some of them were very prominent in the period of the Directory, and then were purged after the coup of the 18th of Fructidor. Others, of course, were ennobled by Napoleon after he got into power. So you have, various viscounts and various counts of this, and I can't remember if Caulaincourt was a marquis before or after, but no, they're very, and of course Bernadotte, I think one of the best examples of social climbing. You start off as a French officer and you end off your career as the King of Sweden. I think only Napoleon is the only person to actually trump Bernadotte in terms of the social climbing of the revolutionary era, and of course the Bonaparte dynasty in general, all of whom were given all of these ridiculous titles. Right, Polish ambassador for 25 zloty. How can you go from bankrupt country into war with whole continent? Was it all just plunder economy? Dead church, royalists, confiscated wealth? Well, yes, there was a large, like I mentioned in my previous lectures, even before the war, Talleyrand had conceived of the idea of the biens nationaux, the idea of the goods of the nation. And this was first of all done targeting the wealth of the church and confiscating all church property. And even that, I mean, the whole basis of speculation from the early French Revolution was the basically a massive property bubble that arose in the wake of this seizure of all this new property by the state. And it was the backing for the original new French currency, the assignat. The assignat wasn't meant to become a currency, but evolved into a currency through necessity. And of course, the printing of the assignat soon outpaced any of the real value of the confiscated goods in France, and it became a worthless hyperinflated currency. So when it comes back to the idea of actually, the Directory bringing in the franc, and of course, Napoleon stabilizing the franc and trying to issue a central bank currency. All of this was done in part due to the plunder economy. It was a huge part of Napoleon's own scheme that we're going to make a fortune going to war through the plunder economy. And of course, he does this in Italy, and he will continue to do this in all of his campaigns. And of course, it's not just the physical wealth, but foraging is a fundamental aspect of the survival of the Grande Armée. So when Napoleon was fighting in virtually impoverished countries such as Spain and of course Russia, the army did very badly. Right. Machiavelli sucks to go for $2. Thank you very much. Who made Napoleon's weapons? Well, French weapons manufacturers, and then weapons manufacturers conscripted throughout all of Europe. So in terms of specifically, I don't actually know enough about the process of French weapon manufacture during this time to be able to tell you that, unfortunately. Right. I understand that there's a new system. I was quite surprised when I saw it, but there's a new system by which people can send me a comment and tip me. I'm not quite sure how that works, but it's been managed nevertheless. So, to those who have sent a comment and a tip on the previous French Revolution videos, I would like to read you out as if you were super chats, and thank you. Mabasa Timmy for 350 New Zealand dollars just says thanks. Thank you very much, Mabasa Timmy. And Pelinor Whitestrake, member of the channel, thank you very much. And this is for £9, so thank you very much. My thanks for these streams. About the only thing keeping me sane between the newborn being awake. Well, that's well. Again, congratulations for the for the coming of your child. I'm very happy to hear that, Pelinor Whitestrick, and I hope parenting isn't too arduous at the moment. But nevertheless, thank you very much, and thank you for supporting the channel. Right, that is it for the super chats for this evening. All I can do is say thank you to everyone who's stuck with this series, this three-part series on the French Revolution. If you want to become a channel member, just click join on the YouTube homepage. Join the Discord. If you like this video and the other lectures, like, subscribe, and leave a comment, and possibly share also. Thank you again, everyone, for listening, and I will see you next week. Sorry, last minute super chat. Machiavelli sucks to go. I mean, Napoleon had millions of weapons, correct? Yes, he would have had millions of weapons. The Grand Armée, well, it's not just Napoleon, this is all of Europe. The Napoleonic super military structure on the eve of the Russian invasion in 1812 had around 600,000 men, estimate. And it wasn't just French, it was Austrians, it was Prussians, Germans of all various stripes, Italians, some Spanish as well, Danish, Swedish, all from all parts of continental Europe. So yes, over the course of the war, there were around the Napoleonic Wars, there were around 3.5 million casualties. So yes, these are vast wars which would only be eclipsed by the First World War over two decades, and they involved vast amounts of weapons, and of course artillery. Napoleon was a general of artillery, lest we forget. So thank you again, everyone, and good night.